Let me add my welcome to Andrew's. We're going to look at that passage in a bit more detail now. So if you've got a Bible, keep it open. And the question I wanted us to begin with as we look at it is this one. Is it time to leave the doctrine of God's judgment behind? If you were with us here last week, I described a conversation that my wife Josie was having with a friend, and Josie was being quizzed or gently interrogated about what Christians believe about God judging and punishing people after death. And I guess as you were hearing that, for some of us at least, we were thinking this is the kind of conversation we want to avoid at all costs. Isn't this really the sort of teaching, not just that the church should be letting go of, but that we certainly don't want others to hear about in the 21st century? Some people actually argue, you may have heard this, that even believing in divine punishment is itself immoral. This guy, the philosopher Bertrand Russell, in his famous essay, Why I Am Not a Christian, he wrote this: I don't myself believe that any person who is really and profoundly humane can believe in everlasting punishment. It's a doctrine which has put cruelty into the world. And what Bertrand Russell is saying there is not simply that he doesn't believe in it and he doesn't hold to this teaching himself. He's arguing that believing in divine punishment leads to injustice, it leads to cruelty in society. So the argument is that this obsession with payback and vengeance from God leads to an obsession with payback and vengeance within society. And he says, look, let's just let that go as primitive. Why can't we just be tolerant and get on with being nice to each other? And of course, there are professing Christians, people like Rob Bell, who have written bestsellers saying exactly this sort of thing. Let's dispense with the idea of hell. Then, as a church, we can start just being nice, being tolerant, and especially we'll have a more attractive message to present to the world. Well, today's passage, as you heard it read just now, it helps us think through this whole topic of divine punishment, and it's going to lead us to some very different conclusions, as we're going to see. And the first thing we see in these verses, this is point one, is that the announcement of judgment is great news. And actually, that picture you can see there is of some Botswana bushmen rejoicing after a judgment, a High Court judgment declaring that they can return to their homes having been evicted. So let's pick up the reading from verse 6 of chapter 14. Then I saw, John says, another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. That word gospel, you may know, just means good news, momentous, great news. So, what is this momentous, great news that heaven is telling us? Verse 7. And he said with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory because the hour of his judgment has come. That's the great news, judgment. And worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. You don't need to spend very long in a children's playground before you hear the words, that's not fair. And the point is that we all are hardwired to long for justice, a just world. And that is why this is such great news to discover in this verse that there is a creator, there is one who made everything and who can and will put things right one day. And it's underlined that it's the creator who's going to do it, the one with total legitimacy. He has every right to do it and all the power he needs to do it thoroughly. It's worth reflecting here just what happens if we then erase belief in a creator. And it's very disturbing to a society when that happens, not just because you then lose hope, you lose the hope of this world being put right in the end, but actually we lose any vocabulary ultimately for even confronting injustice in the here and now. I wonder if you've thought about this. Robert Jarvik, the atheist scientist who created the artificial heart, he said this: in reality, there are no basic human rights. There are conventions we agree to abide by. We are a part of nature. We have no more basic rights than viruses, other than those we create for ourselves. It's a very logical position for someone who doesn't believe in a creator. And what he's saying is this: look, as you look out at the world and you see big viruses destroying little ones or big fish destroying little fish, we look at it and we say, well, that's okay. That's just natural. That's the way it is. But then we say, when big nations or big groups destroy little nations or groups, that is wrong. And Jarvik is just asking the question, why? Why would that be wrong? Of course, unless there's a creator, unless there's a judge outside of nature, above nature, how can we say anything within nature is actually wrong? How can we say anything is crooked unless there is such thing as a straight edge somewhere, a plumb line? So we have to believe in a creator above nature, even to criticize injustice in this world. And so this verse is wonderful news because it tells us that there is a creator and he can and will put things right one day. Now, if you've been with us through this Revelation series, you'll remember something of the context into which this is written. Here are a people who were starting to experience real persecution and injustice. And last week, John, the writer, he pulled back the veil and he showed us that underneath all the glitz and glamour of the Roman Empire, it was actually a beast, he told us, who was demanding allegiance, which should only belong to God. And this beast was deceiving and seducing the nations, and it was devouring the group of people who tried to resist its claims, the Christians. And the next verses that we're going to read bring real comfort to these oppressed people, that God will bring justice on their oppressors. Let's read from verse 8. Another angel, a second, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And they have no rest day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name." Now, I know as I read these are very, very strong words. I think these are some of the strongest words in the whole Bible about judgment. But I wonder if you notice as we're reading that there is no hint of embarrassment in the way they're written. In fact, verse 10, the Lamb, the one who has poured out his own blood for the salvation of the world, Jesus, he will be personally present, ensuring justice is done, and it will be very, very thorough. Famously and sickeningly, Jimmy Savile's gravestone read, "It was good while it lasted." And the idea of someone like Savile, you know, sexual predator in his case, going to his grave in peace and security, with God just ignoring it and smiling down on him as if everything's okay. Rightly, that thought grates with us. And that is why this is such good news. The truth is that God is never mocked. He will bring justice on every oppressor, on every person who is then supporting the vile system. That is the great comfort of these verses. And I know that these verses are hard for any of us to read. And I wonder whether some of our difficulty in reading them actually betrays the fact that we've never really experienced the kinds of injustices experienced by the people who first received this prophecy. That's actually the point that Miroslav Volf makes when he argues against Bertrand Russell's position, that actually we do need a belief in divine justice in order to bring justice and peace in society. So Miroslav Volf, you may have heard of him, he's a Croatian theologian now based at Yale, and he has seen the violence in the Balkans firsthand. And he says that we cannot, in the West, just hand out platitudes like "violence won't solve anything" or "let's all be tolerant" and think that that's somehow going to do anything. He says, and this is his own experience, if you've seen your home plundered, if you've seen your home burned to the ground, if you've seen your daughters and sisters raped, and if you've seen your fathers and brothers having their throats slit, such talk is just laughable. It shows no real concern for justice. And so Volf is asking this question, what is the answer? Is there a way in which our passion for justice can be honoured in a way that doesn't nurture our desire for vengeance. And Wolf says that the best resource for this in the world is having a belief in God's justice. You see, if I don't believe that there is a God who will eventually put all things right, then what will I do? Well, I'll take up the sword myself and I'll be sucked into an endless cycle of retaliation. It's only if I'm convinced that there is a God who will ultimately right every wrong thoroughly, it's only then that I'll have the power to hold back and to find and promote peace. And actually, the more you and I side with, the more we are concerned for persecuted Christians around the world, the more we will delight in and celebrate the truth of this text, that God will vindicate the oppressed and he will punish the oppressors. And actually, this should be a challenge to us, to ask the question ourselves, which side are we on? At the end of World War II, when the Allied forces captured various Nazis and they brought them to trial, the question wasn't, were you sometimes kind to your friends or were you nice to your family? The question was, which side were you supporting? And in these verses, like here in verse 9, God is asking this question, are we part of this world system, the system that is committed to denying God and oppressing his people? The beast, or are we now part of the resistance with whatever hardship will come along with that? But this isn't just a challenge to us. For Christians, it's actually a great encouragement for us to keep going. Actually, that's where the next verse takes us, verse 12. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. So yes, it might be hard for us to stay faithful to Christ, especially when obedience is costly. And I know that's the case for many in this Zoom room, for example. Maybe for you, you're struggling with, you're very conscious of what you've had to leave behind maybe, or you're conscious of the battle you're involved in day by day. And these verses are a great encouragement. God will judge. And on that day, it will be perfectly obvious that following Jesus is the right call. So stick with it. Stick with Jesus. Keep going. That's the call. So that was point one. The announcement of judgment is great news. And next, see how Jesus himself is involved in all this. Name point two there. Jesus has been appointed to gather his people and to judge the wicked. So let's keep going. Verse 14. Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And the language here is from Daniel 7 in the Old Testament. Here we see the risen Jesus, and he's the great son of man. He's the one who's been granted authority to rule this world. And next we read about two harvests. Firstly, there's a grain harvest. And another angel, verse 15, came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, Jesus, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. Now, it doesn't say the words, this is a grain harvest, but that word for ripe literally means dried. It's only used of grain harvests, barley and wheat, and never for grape harvests. So that's what it is. Verse 16, so he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now, you may know from elsewhere in the Bible that the Bible often portrays God as a cosmic farmer. Think of Mark 4, the parable of the sower, for example. God is the one who sows the seed of his word, and then he waters it and he guards it. And then when harvest time comes, he reaps and he gathers his grain into his barn. And this picture of reaping here is a picture of Jesus gathering his people into his kingdom, safely home. And then straight away, we read of another harvest. This time, it's a grape harvest, and it's an angel holding the sickle. So, verse 19, the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great wine press of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. That's 180 miles. That's a lot of blood. And this second harvest has a much more ominous feel to it. And either here, it's either a picture of the wicked being judged directly, or it's a picture of God gathering his martyred people. And then God collects their precious martyr's blood. And then later he pours it out in judgment on their oppressors from seven bowls of wrath in chapter 16. But either way, these two harvests, there's the grain harvest and then the grape harvest. These two harvests represent Jesus gathering his people and then judging the wicked. And whilst this is, of course, what will happen at the end of time, and other parts of the Bible speak about that, here in Revelation 14, I think what's in view is actually a temporal judgment, a mini judgment, which will then point us forward to the final one that's coming. And lots of things, as we've been reading through Revelation, have actually pointed us towards a first century horizon for this judgment, before it then has a secondary meaning beyond that. For example, if you're with us in our Bible studies, we found in the letters to the seven churches that there was an hour of trial coming soon from which the church of that time will be spared. For example, chapter 3, verse 10. Or as we saw last week, the beast seems to represent Rome in particular in the first instance. And later in chapter 17, we'll see there's a reference to Rome's seven hills. So there's clearly a first century flavour there. And even in today's passage, we're going to see chapter 15, verse 4, there's the expectation that after this judgment on Babylon, as it's called, the nations will then be drawn in to worship God. And that certainly points, doesn't it, to the fact that these two harvests represent not the final judgment, but a temporal judgment after which there's still time for people to become Christians. And there's been other clues as we've looked at Revelation as well, like when Andrew was preaching through chapter 6 and we saw how the language there echoes the language Jesus used to prophesy the fall of Jerusalem. People will say to the mountains, fall on us, that kind of language. So I think it's likely to be a temporal judgment. And the two big candidates for that, for what Babylon is, it's either the judgment on Jerusalem, which happened in AD 70, or a judgment on Rome. And either way, the big take home here is that Jesus is the one who has been appointed to gather his people and to judge the wicked. Now, of course, if you were reading this, hearing this in the first century, it certainly didn't look like Jesus was in control, did it? It looked like Christians were being defeated. They kept being killed for their faith. And this chapter shows us beneath the surface what's actually going on. Actually, what's going on is Jesus is reaping. Jesus is gathering his faithful people to safety beyond the grave. And of course, it looked for a while like the persecutors are getting away with it. And yet really we discover here they are on borrowed time. They're about to experience Jesus bringing swift justice on their heads. And of course, the reason it's all in harvest language is to remind us that all of this is just a dress rehearsal, really, for the final judgment, the final ingathering of Jesus' people, the final judgment on the wicked. And what a difference this teaching has made to Jesus' suffering people right through the ages. To know that whatever we're experiencing right now, we can know that Jesus is raised, Jesus is ruling this world, and Jesus will put everything right in the end. One guy who understood this well is this guy. He's called Basil, Basil of Caesarea in the 4th century. I couldn't find an up-to-date picture of him, so I've had to go with the mosaic, which is one. Yeah, it probably looks a bit like him. And this guy was pressured by the emperor, by Valens at the time, to deny his faith. And the prefect who was interrogating Basil, he said to him, "Are you mad that you resist the will before which the whole world bows? Do you not dread the wrath of the emperor or confiscation or exile or death?" "No," said Basil calmly. And then he said this, "You cannot take from me what I do not have. unless you want these tattered rags I wear. You cannot exile me, because every land belongs to God. And as for death, it would be the greatest kindness you could bestow upon me. Do you see the point? Once we understand Jesus is in control, that he will put everything right ultimately, it makes all the difference. We can live with confidence. We can live with joy, whatever happens to be thrown at us. So we've seen, haven't we? Point one, judgment is great news. We've seen point two, Jesus has been appointed. He's in charge of it, including the temporal judgments along the way. And that leads us to our final point, number three there. And trusting this will lead the nations to come and worship. Okay, if you were with us last week, just as at the end of last week's passage, we had a glimpse, didn't we, of the saints gathered around the throne of God. We get the same at the end of this passage as well. Here's a picture. That picture isn't actually of the saints gathered around the throne. It's of cricket fans at Lord's, but it gives us the feel of, you know, the celebration. And it says this: I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, and also those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name, standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. So this is the same sea of glass, we presume, as that we saw in heaven back in chapter 4. But this time there are new worshippers gathered around it, presumably those who have been reaped by the Son of Man in chapter 14. And it goes on, verse 3, and they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and amazing are your deeds, O Lord God, the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. Now, that's an interesting detail there, isn't it? The song of Moses. And it's an allusion. It connects us back to Exodus 15 earlier in the Bible. You probably know that the archetypal salvation moment in the Old Testament was when God divided the waters of the Red Sea. He enabled his people to cross safely. And then when the Egyptians came chasing to attack them, God let the waters return and washed away the Egyptian army. And in one day, God did two things. He gathered his people to safety and he judged his enemies. And straight after this deliverance, Moses and the Israelites sing a song of praise to God. And this is what they sing. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? You can hear that it's very like the song in Revelation 15. And intriguingly, the song doesn't just look backwards and celebrate what's just happened at the Red Sea. The song also looks forwards and it anticipates the effect all this is going to have on the nations. You can't wipe out an entire military force of the greatest superpower on earth without word getting round. And so they anticipate what's going to happen. People are going to sing, this is verse 14, the nations will hear and tremble. The people of Canaan, that's the enemies who currently occupy the promised land, the people of Canaan will melt away. And actually, this melting away with fear was then fulfilled later in the Bible. You may know when the Israelites in Joshua, when they're checking out Jericho, the spies, they come across this woman, Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute. And she helps the spies and she says this, we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. Now that happened 40 years previously, but she's very aware of it. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, same language, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. So do you see the point? As a result of the Lord's victory at the Red Sea, this Canaanite woman, Rahab, and her family, they convert and they start worshipping the true God. And she ends up being one of the ancestors of Jesus. And the point is that this song of Moses is all about how the Lord's deliverance of his people and judgment on his enemies is going to lead to the nations being converted and worshipping the true God. And of course, that is what these saints in heaven in Revelation 15 are singing about. Do you remember the end of their song goes like this? All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. Here we're discovering God's strategy to reach his world through his righteous acts being revealed. This is exactly the way God did it back in the days of Rahab. She discovered, here is a God who delivers his people and punishes his enemies at the Red Sea. Let's side with the true God. This is how God did it supremely at the cross of Jesus. Where else is God's righteousness revealed more clearly than at the cross? God intervened. He brought justice. He reversed humanity's verdict on Jesus. He raised him from the dead. He vindicated him. And now the world can see, here is a God who conquers the grave and brings justice. We better side with the true God. And according to Revelation 15, God is carrying on with this same strategy. So as God enabled his people to conquer the beast through laying down their lives, and as God brought justice on their oppressors in the mini judgment, perhaps the destruction of Jerusalem, the world sees and says, yes, this is the true God, the God whose righteous acts are revealed. We're going to side with the true God. So imagine for a moment the first people who heard these verses. And what an encouragement it would have been for those churches as they heard it for the first time. Yes, the beast may take your life, but don't worry. Not only is God going to bring real justice after your death, but he's even going to use your sacrifice in drawing in the nations to worship him. This is God's great strategy, and you're part of it. I think I've mentioned before at Grace Church that when I was at secondary school, for a time there was another Christian in my year, the appropriately named Christian. And my approach at school was basically to try and blend in. And I was just live like everyone else. Surely if people can see that you can be a Christian and still be one of the lads, or as I tried to be, see that you're completely indistinguishable from everyone else, surely that's going to make the gospel credible and attractive. That was my approach. Whereas Christian took a very different approach. He was distinct. He lived and spoke as a Christian. And as a result of it, he got teased every day at school. It was one of the best games in the class was to try and get Christian to accidentally say something vulgar, or which people are trying to get him to lose his temper, or to say something unkind about someone, or disrespectful about a teacher. And try as people did, it was almost impossible to get him to do it. And every day when Christian decided to keep going and keep taking the flack rather than just blend in, it was a very powerful message he was sending us. He was sending us a message that knowing Jesus is wonderfully precious, and that whatever hardship might come as a result of following Jesus, and there really was quite a lot of it, Jesus can be trusted to put everything right in the end. Now, I want to ask you, which of these two approaches, my approach or Christian's approach, which do you think is likely to have left a lasting impression on all the boys in that class? It's pretty obvious, isn't it? We began with that question. Is it time to leave the doctrine of God's judgment behind? And I hope we can see not simply that the doctrine of God's judgment is wonderful and true. God is going to put the world to rights and it's going to be glorious. But I hope we can see it's exactly what we need. We need to believe it ourselves in order to live faithfully for Christ in this world, like Christian did. And it's this message that there is a judgment as it's proclaimed in our lives, which is ultimately going to enable others to receive the truth. Another friend of mine, who's also one of the barge mission partners out in Namugongo, in Uganda, he told us a story at the barge one time of how in 1886, the king of Buganda, as it was then called, he discovered that I think it was 24 of his servants had become Christians. And the king was very angry about this foreign religion, which was infecting his own palace. And he decided to have them all tied up and laid on a bed of straw and wood. And he told them if they wouldn't recant of their faith, they'd get burned alive. And these were the only believers with any royal influence in the whole country. And they knew that all of that influence could be lost like that if they dug in their heels and were stubborn. And there was massive pressure on them actually just to duck below the, just to blend in. And the argument was that for the long-term gospel influence, just fit in this once. But actually all 24 of them, and some of them were still only teenagers, they chose to take the hit and they were burned alive rather than disowning Christ. And actually as a result of their very brave stand, in time the king himself, who saw their faith, saw that they believed in a final judgment, he turned to Christ. And that opened the door for the gospel to spread rapidly through that nation. And you probably know that now a majority of people in Uganda are professing Christians. That photo is actually of the Martyrs' Day, which happens every year when people come from all over the country to commemorate the sacrifice of these 24 servants at the Martyrs' Memorial in Namugongo. So the point is that you and I can trust Jesus is going to put everything right one day. And that will give us courage that we can live for Jesus, whatever the consequences. And wonderfully, we discover that this is God's strategy for reaching the nations as we trust him.